This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a fascinating program today. I hope you'll stick around to hear all of it. In our second segment, this is one that I don't think you'll forget anytime soon. It's a story from the 1960s about a tribe in northern Uganda and an anthropologist who lived with them for 2 years and wrote a book about it. What happens in a community devoid of any sense of unity, of responsibility to one another, no sense of cooperation or looking out for each other, basically just every man for himself? Well, this tribe shows what happens, and you can't help but take it as a warning about the direction society is going today. We'll hear a report about this from KPCG station manager Dwight Falk. We'll also hear about a recent archaeological find in Israel, an enormous gate to a city mentioned repeatedly in the Bible, and that may bring more evidence to the Bible's account of King David. We'll talk with archaeologist and trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about this. And I'll share my own experience when I went to summer camp as a teenager, helped my relationship with my parents. We have a summer camp going here at our offices in Edmond, Oklahoma right now. And so I wanted to share this lesson with you. We're going to start the program, though, in Mexico. If you are Mexican or you're concerned for Mexico's future, you're probably closely watching what's happening in this country, developments that led to the recent election of a new president who plans to take the country in a very different direction. But even if you are American or you're concerned for America's future, you need to know what's going on in Mexico. It has enormous implications, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Beset by corruption, poverty, and violence, Mexico's voters just elected a socialist strongman to lead their country. This is bad news for the United States. Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador was elected president of Mexico on July 1st in a landslide victory. He received 53% of the vote, the first time a presidential candidate has been elected with an absolute majority since 1988. And he will be sworn into office for a six-year term this December. López Obrador's coalition includes his Movement for National Regeneration, the far-left Labor Party, and the Evangelical Social and Counterparty. The coalition won 307 out of 500 seats in the Chamber of Deputies and 69 out of 128 seats in the Senate. That's almost enough to pass changes to the Constitution of Mexico. Now, Mexican historian Enrique Krause has hailed López Obrador as a tropical messiah whose charismatic leadership can save Mexico from a corrupt elite. But others are less optimistic. They see the left-wing president as a populist strongman akin to Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, Turkish President Recep Erdogan, and the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. So where will López Obrador take Mexico? Many analysts say his policies on economics, criminal justice, and immigration could set his nation on a path toward Venezuela-style meltdown. And the Bible strongly indicates that such a scenario will occur in the near future. Longtime listeners to this program know that the peoples of Britain and the United States are descended from the ancient Lost Ten Tribes of Israel. You can request a free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong to explain this astonishing truth. And in the Old Testament, God likens end times Israel to a hedged vineyard protected on all sides. But because of the sins of the people, God foretells of a time when the hedge will be removed. "I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard," God says in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 5. "I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. I will break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down." Today we see the hedge on America's southern border already being torn down. In the United States, López Obrador is being called the Bernie Sanders of Mexico. Yet many officials within his movement are far-left revolutionaries. The Secretary General of his coalition speaks openly of her admiration for the late Cuban President Fidel Castro and the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. And she acknowledges that her party seeks to incorporate Mexico into the Bolivarian Revolution, a political revolution in Venezuela that seeks to build an anti-American coalition of nations based on principles of nationalism and socialism. The president for the Morena Commission of Honesty and Justice is another key official enamored with Venezuela's socialist revolution. He said last October in a video broadcast, "Let's say it straight. The integration of Mexico into the Bolivarian Revolution would, in my opinion, make a big difference in the situation we have now. We need to expand that revolution." So now that the largest political party in Mexico is openly endorsing Venezuela's socialist dictatorship, political analysts are predicting that López Obrador's administration will forge political alliances with Bolivia, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Such alliances with anti-American regimes would mandate that Mexico turn away from the United States to forge closer ties with U.S. rivals. And this would hasten a time when America is besieged by foreign powers. In addition to promising economic revolution, López Obrador has also promised to revolutionize the way Mexico deals with drug-related violence. International drug trafficking networks known as cartels employ about 600,000 people in Mexico. These cartels take in between $19 billion and $29 billion annually, making them wealthy enough to field their own armies. Approximately 15,000 trained fighters work for the cartels, which are equipped with drones, grenades, landmines, machine guns, and even armored vehicles and submarines. All this money and firepower equate to the drug lords controlling over 45% of Mexico, including the western mountain states and the northern borderland states. López Obrador has promised to tackle cartel violence by rewriting the rules of the drug war. He has suggested granting amnesty to drug traffickers and a strategy nicknamed Hugs, Not Bullets. He wants to reduce crime by creating jobs for young people instead of punishing them for their role in the drug trade. And he has also indicated that he's open to the possibility of legalizing drugs and negotiating with cartel bosses. Yet his Hugs, Not Bullets strategy represents a ceasefire at best. Mexico's homicide rate may come down if the government stops fighting drug trafficking networks. But cartel bosses will still control half the country and will face less resistance, enabling them to expand their power further. And if López Obrador's socialist policies cause an economic collapse like the one that has devastated Venezuela, his ceasefire may leave the cartels basically in charge of the country. Yet López Obrador seems more concerned about U.S. President Donald Trump than he is about cartel bosses. In a book published in 2016 entitled Listen Up, Trump, Obrador says that Trump and his advisors speak of the Mexicans the way that Hitler and the Nazis referred to the Jews just before they undertook their infamous persecution and their abominable extermination. In another speech, he promises to defend the immigrants of the world who by necessity have to leave their villages to seek life in the United States. Now, socialism, drug-related violence, and the immigrant crisis are creating a perfect storm that could soon transform Mexico into a failed state and send untold numbers of people fleeing north into the United States. This is leading to a time where America's hedges are torn down and its inheritance is eaten up. It's a wake-up call for every American to ask what they might be doing to have brought such chastisement upon ourselves.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Here we have yet another nation where people are upset at the status quo and they're voting in outsiders, these populist-type leaders who have strongman tendencies, right on America's southern border.
Yeah, it is a amazing trend to watch just because it's happened in so many nations, in some ways even coincidentally, because it's not necessarily the same issues that are always propelling these populist strongmen to the forefront. But in so many places, people are just, they're tired of the old way of doing things. They're looking for change. Mm-hmm. They're rebelling against the establishment. And you're just seeing like common everyday people rally around like a strong political figure.
Those numbers are extraordinary. I mean, the number of seats that he has in the legislature, this is massive.
It is massive, and especially a country like Mexico that's really kind of been ruled by an aristocratic elite since colonial times. I think many analysts think their first free and fair election didn't happen until the year 2000. And the main political party in Mexico ruled for like 71 years uninterrupted until about 2000, when another party took power for like a few years. And now this López Obrador's party is a new third party that really hasn't been on the scene before, with over 30 million voters. Like I said, first time since the 80s that a president's won with a majority. And if he can get even one other party to support a measure, he's about to the point where he can start making changes to the Constitution itself.
Well, definitely no difficulty to recognize that what was happening wasn't working. So you could definitely see why the people of Mexico would want change. But can you elaborate, maybe you talked about this in the report, but on the precedents that we see in Venezuela and other countries that show the effects of some of the policies he's advocating?
Yeah, Venezuela was quite similar, actually, and it's also a former Spanish colony ruled over by an aristocratic elite for many years until the poor eventually got sick of it, rose up in the Bolivarian Revolution, and nationalized Venezuela's oil sector. Established a democratic socialist regime, took the wealth from the elite, took the wealth from the rich, and redistributed it, which seemed to work out pretty well for the poor of Venezuela for about 10 years, until it's kind of like Margaret Thatcher said, that socialism only works till you run out of other people's money to spend. Mm-hmm. And then without that incentive to keep their economy going, they've just experienced a tremendous economic collapse. Now I think they said about 10% of the Venezuelan population has fled the country as refugees. Mm-hmm. Similar with Mexico, López Obrador is calling, or has called in the past, for the nationalization of Mexico's oil sector, and has put forward many wealth redistribution programs to take money from the rich and give it to the poor, really kind of using Venezuela as a template in a lot of ways. Maybe not quite as extreme as what Hugo Chavez did, but definitely trending in that direction. And that is a concern, is that maybe in the short run, that might alleviate some poverty in Mexico, but everywhere else these economic policies have been tried, within a fairly short number of years, they've led to an even worse poverty crisis that will push more and more people out of the country. One of López Obrador's particular proposals that has could exacerbate the immigration crisis is he's calling for like big raises in the minimum wage, and you can see like a third of Mexico lives on less than $6 a day. So you could see why that would be appealing to hear a call on the minimum wage. But you've already got millions of Mexican illegal immigrants in the United States because they can't find good job opportunities in Mexico. And if you raise the minimum wage, making it even harder to get work, you could definitely see a big spike in illegal immigration to the U.S.
Well, we definitely need to keep our eyes on this situation. He's taking office later this year. I think it's December. It's quite a lengthy preparation process, but he's already putting forth policies and getting ready to hit the ground running once he's in office. We'll have to watch closely what happens there and to see how it impacts those prophecies that you were describing there in your report. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's working on an article on this subject, what's happening in Mexico. This is for the September 2018 print edition of the Trumpet Magazine. You can watch the website for that in the next couple of weeks. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A common romantic liberal idea is that of the noble savage, the primitive person untainted by the corrupting influence of civilization and who represents mankind's inherent goodness. Well, we're about to hear an example of the exact opposite of that in this report from Dwight Falk.
Imagine a society where no one gave and everyone sought only to get for themselves. What kind of a life would that be? There is a recent society that descended into this selfish madness. Anthropologist Colin M. Turnbull lived among the Eek tribe in northern Uganda from 1964 to 1967. He wrote a book based on this experience titled The Mountain People, which was published in 1972. Mr. Turnbull dedicated his book this way: "For the Eek, whom I learned not to hate." What Turnbull witnessed in his time with the Eek stirred his emotions to hatred and finally an empty indifference. He experienced a society with about 2,000 members at the time that had forgotten how to be human. They had lost the ability to love, to hope, or to help. In short, the Eek had abandoned any semblance of living the give way and had completely embraced the way of get. In the Eek, Turnbull believed he saw the end result of what was happening in Western societies. He wrote that the Eek had cultivated individualism to its apex. Their only concern was filling their own stomachs while working to keep everyone else's stomach empty. They lived a life of complete selfishness, and while being in a group physically, each member lived in total emotional isolation. As Turnbull observed the Eek's selfish culture, he sought to understand their motivations. He asked the Eek what their native word for good was. The word translated basically as food. And he learned that a good man was a man with food in his own stomach. The younger Eek would literally steal food out of the mouths of the elderly, waiting until they had chewed it. Young men hoarded excess food to themselves while their fathers and family members died of starvation a few feet away. Apparently, it hadn't always been this way with the Eek. Though not a lot is known about them, most believe they were hunters and gatherers for many years, but eventually they were forced to take on a more agrarian lifestyle. At one time, it appears that they held together in family units, but eventually this was all abandoned. Turnbull witnessed many examples of the total breakdown of the family structure. In one instance, he records witnessing the Eek having to quickly move a village. The young left the old, literally stepping over them without concern. He wrote this: "There was a sudden exodus from the village, distant shouts of laughter. I went to see what the excitement was about. It was someone else whom I had never seen before, Dead Lolim's widow. She too had been abandoned and had tried to make her way down the mountainside, but she was totally blind and had tripped and rolled to the bottom. And there she lay on her back, her legs and arms thrashing feebly, while a little crowd standing on the edge above looked down at her and laughed at the spectacle. But no one cared to help her." At this point, Turnbull intervened, bribing the old widow's own community with food and money to help her to the new village. He wrote, "So we gave her more food and made her eat and drink all she could, but put her stick in her hand and pointed her the way she wanted to be pointed, and suddenly she cried. Thinking she was afraid or wanted us to go with her, I asked, and she said no. She was crying, she said, because all of a sudden we had reminded her that there had been a time when people had helped each other, when people had been kind and good." The Eek, in a matter of two generations, had forgotten how to give or to care or to love. They were in a vicious cycle. The Eek would kick their children out of their homes when they turned 3 years old. The children would band together, not in friendship, but only to survive. The leader of the pack, who was the oldest and largest child, would eventually be pushed off a cliff by the one seeking to replace him. And growing up without being loved or cared for, the Eek children grew to adults and returned the favor by beating and starving the elderly. In Eek culture, children were not good for anything, and neither were the elderly. The only value was in the strong who could get for themselves. In one numbing example of selfishness, a woman was carrying her baby in a sling while she gathered food in the forest. Not caring for the child, she dropped the sling to the ground with the child in it. While the mother wandered off in search for food, a leopard came and ate the child. The mother was delighted because she no longer had to be burdened with the child, and the leopard would be sleeping after its meal. The tribe found and killed the leopard, then they ate it and the baby inside of it. The mother felt she won on two accounts. She no longer had to look after the baby, and she got a meal. And this made perfect sense to their warped thinking. In two of the years that Turnbull was with the Eek, they experienced a great drought, and so food was scarce. It would be easy to assume that their despicable behavior was simply an effort to survive the famine. But what the Eek did with what they received speaks volumes about how their way of get became so ingrained that they persisted in that way even when they had plenty. The government provided aid rations for the Eek during the drought years, and the rations had to be controlled from a central location and distributed to each tribe member. The younger members of the tribe, who were the strongest, went to collect the aid. Partway back to the village, they stopped and gorged themselves on the food, so much so that they vomited. They brought nothing back for the starving elderly and children in their village. Remember, they said a good man was one with food in his own belly, even if it was more than their belly could hold. In the third year that Turnbull was with the Eek, the rains came to Uganda. There was a bumper crop and fields overflowed. Did this change the Eek? Sadly, no. They decided they could get more from government aid and without effort, so they left the food to rot in the fields. They would take all they could get personally and not share, and they would not work together. Turnbull wrote that the Eek had created a monstrous society that was, quote, a passionless, feelingless association of individuals that would spread like a fungus, contaminating all it touched. In his conclusion, Turnbull made this startling statement. The symptoms of change in our society indicate that we are heading in precisely the same direction. The Eek give us a look at what the get way of life looks like in full bloom, or in total rot. The Eek lost even natural affection between friends and neighbors, children and parents. Their history illustrates what the world would be like without give, and it is the worst kind of horror show. What made Colin Turnbull so disillusioned after his time with the Eek was the realization of how evil man can become. But what he didn't know was the solution to the problem. And God's word gives a solution. Acts 20 and verse 35 records how Christ said it is more blessed to give than to receive. And God created family so we can practice the give way in our own homes. God's law shows us how to give. It is a law of liberty, one that frees us from the terrible prison of the get way of life. God's law commands that children love and honor their parents, and that the parents love and provide for and teach their children. All are taught to honor the elderly, and the elderly are told to instruct the young. The beauty of God's plan is that it does include every person who has ever lived, including the Eek. They will have an opportunity to learn God's way of give. And as we look back on the Eek culture and see our modern societies becoming more selfish, we should be all the more motivated to live God's give way of life and diligently teach it to our own children.
Pretty chilling.
Very.
The fellow that that did this, the anthropologist Turnbull, he studied other cultures as well. When he went into this, he must have had some idea of what he was expecting to see, and then when he saw the way that they were acting, he became very disillusioned. Can you just explain how that, maybe what his thoughts were going in and how that changed?
Yeah, when he started out, he was hoping to learn more about this tribe. There wasn't a lot known about them. And he had studied other tribes and written books that, are published. And he talks about a tribe that he observed in a jungle region. I think it was in the Amazon. And they were different than we are in the West. And they do things differently, but he learned to appreciate the way they did things. There was a reason for what they were doing. And so even though the structure of things was different than what he was familiar with in a Western culture, he could appreciate why they did things a certain way. Going into this, he thought he would discover the same sort of thing. Like, sure, they'll be different. They'll do things differently, but there'll be some logic to it or some reason to it. And as he told some of the local authorities that he wanted to study this Eek tribe, he did kind of get this look like, you probably don't want to be involved with them. And he just pushed on, and he wanted to learn about them. And that's what he was grappling with as he observed them and he wrote this book. You know, what's the method? What's the reason for what they're doing? There has to be a reason. He tried to find out if they had a belief in a god. Did they have a belief in you know, some sort of societal structure? And the more he looked, the more empty it was. It was very disillusioning for him.
That's amazing. I think the example that you used about how they were treating each other this way in the deprived conditions, and then once you had government aid coming in and they were receiving this material without having to work for it at all, that only intensified. But you mentioned this this older woman who remembered what it was like not that long before that. And so we're talking about a rapid unraveling of any sense of community within this group of people. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, you can't help but, in listening to this, just think about the ties to what we see happening today in society in many ways. You mentioned that they lost their natural affection one for another. And of course, those words are straight out of that prophecy in 2 Timothy, that this is actually something that would happen in the end time. And we see examples that, I mean, they're not on the scale of what you're describing here, but it's similar types of things where people just have no sense of responsibility or obligation to other members in their family or their community.
Yeah, and that's what Turnbull saw, and that was in the 70s when he was writing this. And he uses some examples at the end of the book. Really, that's kind of his conclusion, is that, look, we're not that far removed. We might think we are. We're a little further advanced as far as some technology. But if you look at the just underlying principles of selfishness, he saw it. And he gives examples from the 1970s. He said, well, you know, the Eek kick their children out at 3. Well, people kick their children into daycare. He says, I mean, he had different ideas about things that he thought weren't the best. But he could see an unraveling of the West as well. And that's what scared him. And he also just didn't have the spiritual perspective of God's word. And so he was very much lost. Like, what is man? Mm-hmm. Is there goodness? Did we make it up? You know, because you can lose it.
Right.
And that's what shocked him, was how fast you can lose these values that many people hold to be very, you know, intrinsic within the human experience. And he said they can disappear fast.
Right. Yeah, the reality is that it's those civilizing influences of a societal structure, the strictures that come with a belief in religion, you know, just a moral code that society helps you with. The idea that all of that just kind of naturally blossoms within someone that doesn't have those kinds of guidelines, really, there's a whole lot of evidence that shows that's just not the case.
Yeah, he came. It was amazing. It's amazing to read this book, because just through physical observation, he came to a spiritual truth, but he didn't understand it for what it was. And that is that man is not inherently good, which a lot of people think is the case.
Right.
That man has an inherent goodness. And he saw firsthand that the opposite is true.
Yeah.
And without understanding God's plan for man and so forth, he was left disillusioned, to say the least, yeah. frightened. And he died a few years back, and one of the main papers over there in the UK revisited his book a little bit and said, hey, he gave us this warning, and it might be something to think about. That was back in the, I think, late 90s, that they remembered what he had written and said, you know, we should probably look at our society. And like you pointed out, all you have to do is check your headlines, and you see some terrible examples of just complete selfishness and lack of natural affection. Not maybe as widespread as, say, that community, but still you see it every day in the news.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with KPCG station manager Dwight Falk about the Eek tribe of northern Uganda in the 1960s. He's working on an article about this subject. It's called The Selfish People. Watch for it on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Dwight.
You're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Archaeologists in Israel recently found an enormous gate to a city mentioned repeatedly in the Bible. This may bring more evidence supporting the biblical account of King David, as we'll hear in this report from Brent Noctegal, submitted from Jerusalem.
2 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, in the fertile delta of the Jordan River, lies Tel Etel, an ancient city that is likely the biblical city of Bethsaida. During the time of Christ, this was the hometown of the apostles Peter, Andrew, and Philip, and also the location of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. Every year, a team of archaeologists head back to the site to see what more can be discovered, and this year the excavators were in for a real treat. However, the landmark discovery was not from the time of the Gospels, but rather 1,000 years earlier, from the time of King David. According to excavation director Professor Rami Arav, this season's dig yielded a massive gate complex which was in use from sometime in the 11th century BC to 920 BC when the city suffered a destruction. Since David ruled around 1000 BC, this gate was definitely in use during his kingship. With a preserved height around 3 meters, Arav says that it is the largest and best preserved gate in the land of Israel from that period. While that's probably debatable, this is most definitely a substantial gate. For Israel, gate complexes held a highly important community function. Often, city leaders could be found at the gate adjudicating cases that had come to their attention. At other times, it was at the gate where merchants and businessmen would trade their wares with travelers. And when idolatry was in vogue, it was often at the gate where sacrifices would be brought to offer to the deity. And so, finding a gate at an archaeological site is significant because this is the location where the real business took place, and the gate at Tel Etel is no exception to that rule. It's not just the size of this gate that's important, but rather what might have taken place there, and how it relates to the biblical narrative. 1500 years before the time of Jesus Christ, this city was already in use. Remains from the late Bronze Age or the time of Joshua's conquest of the Promised Land have also been discovered at the site. The Bible records that although this land was given to the tribe of Manasseh, they weren't able to drive out all the inhabitants, whom the Bible calls the Geshurites. The people of Geshur were an elusive group that may have been a subgroup of the Arameans, who occupied the area to the northeast, including Damascus. Nevertheless, the Bible squarely indicates that they lived in this area, from the time of Joshua and through the time of King David and Solomon. And given that Tel Etel is the largest of the settlements in the area, it stands to reason that this was the capital city of the Geshurites. And this is where the story gets interesting, especially in relation to biblical history. During the last year and a half before King Saul's death, we are introduced to the Geshurites once again. This is the time that King David, though not yet a king, was on the run with a band of rebels from King Saul. With King Saul getting tired from years of chasing David, and because of David's league with the king of the city of Gath, David uses this time to gain some territory for his large entourage of 600 men and their families. This history is recorded in 1 Samuel 27, verses 3 to 7. It says this: And David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. And David said unto Achish, If now I have found favour in thine eyes, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country, that I may dwell there, for why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? Then Achish gave him Ziklag that day, wherefore Ziklag belonged unto the kings of Judah unto this day. And the number of the days that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and made a raid upon the Geshurites and the Gizrites and the Amalekites. And so David makes a raid on the Geshurites. And just after that raid takes place, the Philistine army decides to take on King Saul. It defeats them in the north of Israel, putting to death Saul and his son Jonathan. The next 7 years saw bitter infighting among the Israelites and the tribe of Judah. The dynasty of Saul continued to attempt to rule over Israel in the face of Philistine threats, while David reigned as king only over the southern tribe of Judah. And while Jerusalem remained yet uncaptured, David ruled from Judah's capital, Hebron. Now with that in mind, notice what it says in 2 Samuel 3, verse 1 to 3. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, but David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. And unto David were sons born in Hebron, and his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and his second, Chileab of Abigail the wife of Nabal the Carmelite, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maachah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. Now, while living at Hebron during these 7 years, before Israel's united under David, David has many children from different women, and the third that is mentioned, that wasn't mentioned in the earlier accounts from Gath, is Maachah, who is the daughter of Talmai, king of none other than Geshur. It stands to reason, then, that during the time of the raid on Geshur, or sometime shortly thereafter, King David came to wed the daughter of the king of Geshur. And given that Tel Etel is the royal city of the Geshurites, did David make that arrangement or proposal at the gate of that city, the gate that was just discovered? Certainly that's a possibility, and we'll really never know for sure. Now we know that the city was huge, and we know that the Geshurites must have been a formidable people, at least compared to the Israelites at the beginning of David's reign. And yet David is strong enough and powerful enough to marry a princess of the royal house of Geshur. Now as the evidence at Tel Etel reveals, the site continued to be inhabited during the reign of King David. And David's third son, Absalom, who was also the son of Maachah the Geshurite, would actually retreat back to the house of his grandfather, the Geshurite king Talmai, after killing his half-brother, Amnon, and ended up staying there for 3 years. After being accepted back into the fold in Jerusalem, he staged a revolt against his own father David. But while the coup would eventually fail, and Absalom killed for his treachery against his father's house, the Bible records that the family of Geshur would still become part of David's royal line. Absalom would have a daughter whom he named after his mother Maachah, and she would be the very favorite wife of Solomon's son Rehoboam. And it was from their relationship that the next king of Judah, Abijah, was born. After this point, Etel suffered a brief destruction, perhaps at the hands of Pharaoh Shishak of Egypt, after which it looks to have been absorbed into the northern kingdom of Israel, where it would continue to exist until eventually suffering the same fate as the northeastern tribes of Israel. In 732 BC, Tel Etel's 6-meter-thick city wall was breached and destroyed by the mighty Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser III. Nevertheless, that's definitely not where this story ends. With only 4% of the entire site now excavated, we can only guess at what material remains from the time of the kings of Israel are yet to be unearthed.
Thanks very much, Brent. That is a really fascinating discovery. And you say that you believe that this really supports the biblical view or the biblical narrative about King David. Can you explain how you think that is?
Yeah, well, while this discovery didn't take place as far as in an Israelite site, we talk about the sites that David built up quite a lot. This was a kingdom that looked to be in league with David. But the biblical account specifically talks about how David married the princess, a royal princess of this kingdom. And for a king to give up his princess in a political alliance, a king that can have such a large gatehouse, huge fortified walls, such a large settlement, kind of indicates as well that David was at least equal, or this would have been this, that this political marriage would have been a good idea for the king and the Geshurites as well. Now, people listening to the program might be like, well, duh, David was much bigger than even this guy. And yes, you're probably right. But that's not where we are as far as the debate goes in archaeological circles. Archaeological circles are either in the camp that David was as the Bible describes, but many are saying that David was far smaller than that. And even the archaeologist that excavated this area, he talked about a scenario in another interview, a scenario where David just came, a hillbilly guy just came up to the town and for the sake of the biblical story, the princess was given away to him or something like that.
Right.
Which
this was in this was in the Times of Israel report on the discovery.
Right. And I don't, you know, he might have said it tongue in cheek. He said it as he was laughing, but it does speak to that kind of idea that you didn't have, it wasn't David from a position of power going to this large city and saying, hey, you know, we're having, you know, give me your daughter or something to that regard. Of course, David at this time had many wives. He eventually put them all away, but at this time he did marry many different women from different places, all of them surrounding Israel, all of them, it seems, probably somewhat related to the Israelites. But this kind of shows that, yeah, David is at least an equal footing with this kingdom. David wasn't a hillbilly guy. Jerusalem wasn't a tiny little town. He didn't even take Jerusalem yet. And already he's big enough to make away with the daughter of this king.
Well, you talked about this on your report this last week, the Watch Jerusalem podcast from this past Sunday, and just compared, say, the way that this archaeologist spoke about it with what actually the Bible says about this exchange between David and this city. Just talk about that a little bit.
Well, the biblical narrative we kind of have to put things together, and it doesn't speak specifically about David going to this city. It does speak about him raiding the Geshurites, talking about him taking certain, probably of their not necessarily captivity, but he brought them underneath his heel. That's what the Bible says. And then all of a sudden we have a wife that used to be the princess of the Geshurite kingdom. And now he's David's wife, his third wife. And it just
so does. It almost seems more like this is part of the spoils of war or something like that. This is a conquest type of a situation rather than him going cap in hand or them doing him a favor.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to go cap in hand to a king and say, give me your daughter. You could say that they're, you know, got some weird, you know, Romeo Juliet love affair going on, but it isn't like that. He's already got a couple wives and he's going to get a few more before it's all out. And so this was a political marriage that would have benefited the Geshurites more than it would have David.
And that's fact that we're seeing the grandeur of these ruins kind of gives you a sense of the reality politically.
Right. If the capital city of Geshur is massive, if it's got 6 meter wide walls, and this is the town that existed when David was there, surely David's kingdom's got to be equal to bigger than that, or at least be able to have construct such buildings. And that is not the narrative that is promoted in many archaeological circles today.
Right.
They would like to do away with Davidic grandeur.
So you can see why they would have that view if the pre-existing assumption is that David was weak. But you would think that as evidence of the biblical account of King David continues to stack up and to prove the Bible accurate, that people would start giving that biblical account more respect?
I would hope so. And I do feel like that might be happening slowly. In a way, I look at the Bible and I take that the account of the Bible is accurate, and then the finds would support that kind of thing. Other people have looked for the finds on the ground and then look at the Bible and say, it doesn't support it. And 30 years ago, they were making that case. And 30 years ago, they might have had a case, more of a case, to give that opinion. But in the past 25 years, there's been discoveries, especially since 2005, David's Palace, Kirbet Kayafa, we've talked about, even this town that was found outside Beersheba earlier this year with a large Davidic period wall. No, that was down by Hebron. They all speak to David's grandeur.
Yeah.
And so there is more and more proof coming out of that.
So you, just in the couple of minutes we have remaining, you recently had an interview with Scott Stripling, another archaeologist in Israel. Can you just tell us about how that went?
Yeah, he does have a similar approach to Dr. Mazar in the way that he excavates. He does believe the Bible is an accurate source. It should be used just as we would use other historical texts from the time, and do our research about the places that we're excavating. He excavates at Tel Shiloh. Shiloh, of course, is very important in the biblical narrative. And he looks at the Bible and he looks at Shiloh and he says, well, what has happened here? There should have been, the tabernacle was here for over 300 years, so we should find evidence of some type of sacrificial system, which he does, which is interesting, as he related Finkelstein, who came out with the idea that David, one of them that came out with the idea that David was nothing but a hillbilly. He excavated the same place 20 years before Stripling, and he found the same mass of bones and ash and everything. But he didn't come out with the opinion that, well, that's because the tabernacle was here and the altar was here. He had a totally different opinion about it because he disregarded the historical text that has a story about Shiloh doing something where events like that took place. So here is a man that is excavating there every year. He said he's got the largest team in Israel. I think he has over 200 people on the site.
Wow.
This past year, which is just massive logistically to accomplish that feat and make sure it's all documented well. And he is highly respected as well. He's not a Bible basher that goes there, just hacks away and tries to find treasure. No, he's very highly respected in the archaeological field all around the world. And so we're going to maintain contact with him going forward. He's just a very nice man. I think he lives in Texas. And so he'll be coming back next year to excavate, and hopefully we'll definitely go out to the site and take a look ourselves. But what he's got coming up, I feel he's finding evidence of some type of religious service there at Shiloh, indicative of the Israelites and things that would have involved in the tabernacle service. As he said, we're not going to find the tabernacle because it was made out of animal skins and such.
Mm.
But you can find the tools that they used to serve the and the different ornaments that were used in the tabernacle service. And he found one of those motifs. He found a nice pomegranate, which is only has religious connotations to the Israelites in that period, in the right stratigraphical layer to relate to the tabernacle right there. And so I think he's just getting to the start of what could be found at Shiloh.
Outstanding. Well, we've been talking with archaeologist and trumpet writer Brent Nachtigal about recent finds in Israel that verify the biblical narrative. There's a lot of information where this came from at our sister website, which Brent curates, watchjerusalem.co.il. You can hear recent episodes, one that has that Scott Stripling interview, and then this most recent one. It's called Massive 3,000-Year-Old Gate Found at Potential Hometown of Absalom's Mother. Thanks for your time, Brent.
No problem.
It's time for today's last word.
The summer I turned 17 was somewhat of a low point in my relationship with my parents. It wasn't terrible, but it seemed we were arguing over more and more silly things. I thought they didn't trust me. They thought I was drifting away from them. But something happened that began to turn that relationship around. That summer, I spent 3 weeks in Orr, Minnesota at a summer educational program, SEP. It was a camp sponsored by my church. It was full of activities, sports, water skiing, a canoe trip, dorm life, dances, as well as instruction in Bible studies, fireside chats, fellowship with ministers. And I realized at that camp that I had not been honoring my parents as I should have been. I resolved that when I returned home, I would do my part to make the relationship better. I didn't realize it at the time, but this change in my attitude was actually fulfilling an Old Testament prophecy. In a letter he wrote in 1984, Herbert W. Armstrong, the man who founded the church I attended, the Worldwide Church of God, he wrote this: "Here in Australia, I have visited the SEP summer camp for youths 13 to 18 years of age. Words simply cannot describe the importance of these summer camps. These hundreds of young people will be adults being married and having children in just one decade. They are learning God's way of fun, and they're being taught God's truth. Their lives are being changed. These camps and the church YOU program for youths worldwide," and I'll talk about this in just a little bit, "they're turning the hearts of the children to their parents and the parents to their children. And in this age when families are being broken up and youths are turning to alcohol, drugs, sex, and violence and becoming strangers to their parents, that is one of the vital things God is doing through his church, as prophesied in Malachi 4 and verse 6. That's the prophecy I was talking about. And later in this letter, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "Not only are these summer camps of such supreme importance, but also our program of working with you parents so you may come closer to your children." He wrote this: "I call on you to have a closer relationship with your children. The last two verses of the Old Testament are a prophecy showing how important that is for you today." So this is what those verses say. Malachi 4, verses 5 to 6. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." Those words beautifully describe Mr. Armstrong's work. Over his 57-year ministry, he worked intensively to build families and turn hearts. The YOU program he mentioned was Youth Opportunities United. As a teen, I attended regular YOU sporting events, dances, talent showcases, fundraisers, and socials with my peers and my parents. In its publications, the church printed regular articles on marriage and family. They taught about dating, sex, childbirth, every aspect of every phase of parenting and child development, even grandparenting. Beginning in 1981, it began printing Youth Magazine for teens with frequent articles on building strong intergenerational relationships. Mr. Armstrong also founded three campuses of Ambassador College to teach true values to young people. Every effort was made to give graduating students the best possible foundation for happy, productive marriages and families. Ministers also offered counseling to couples considering marriage in order to help them build successful and enduring families. This was all specifically meant to fulfill Malachi's prophecy. It was a job Mr. Armstrong took very seriously. And at the heart of the issue was the deep biblical truth that we are preparing now to enter God's eternal family. That's why success in building our families today is so important. It gets us ready for our future. After Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, the Worldwide Church of God turned its back on this legacy of Bible-based family instruction. Within 4 years, though, the Philadelphia Church of God was founded. That's the church that sponsors this website and this radio broadcast. And right away, it resumed the work of turning the hearts of family members toward one another. We provide solid scriptural instruction on building strong families and many other topics in our magazines, The Trumpet, The Royal Vision, on our websites, thetrumpet.com and pcog.org. Our magazine, True Education, is for teens, and it helps young people navigate life and guides them toward closer relationships with their parents and with God. Ambassador College is now closed, but Herbert W. Armstrong College has filled the gap. Our ministers regularly provide marriage counseling and child-rearing help to our members, and we hold Philadelphia Youth Camp here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and in the Philippines and Australia. If we do our job right, we will help turn the hearts of those young people toward their fathers, just like mine was turned to my parents because of the work of Herbert W. Armstrong. I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Dwight Falk, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Joseph de Maistre. I do not know what the heart of a rascal may be. I know what is in the heart of an honest man. It is horrible. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.